So I guess we can start. I hope my voice holds up for the talk. It's a bit unreliable right now. I just come off a bit of a cold, and that's why the meditation wasn't quite up to scratch this evening. But anyway, so we'll see how things go. And the talk this evening is going to be on Sangha, the monastic community, and the importance of Sangha, the importance of a monastic community in Buddhism. Why does it matter? Does it have any special function? What is the whole purpose of the Sangha? Why did the Buddha lay down this institution known as the monastic order? And I think one reason why it is important to talk about this topic is because there is a tendency sometimes, especially in Buddhism in the West, to think that Sangha doesn't matter so much. The monastic order is kind of perhaps not relevant, right? These are modern times, things change. What was true 2,500 years ago is not necessarily true today. And of course, there is some truth to that. So to look at this fully, we need to understand the idea, the kind of plan of the Buddha. What is the whole function of the monastic order within the larger idea of Buddhism? And you can see that tendency sometimes in the West already, that movement away from the Sangha. For one thing, there's often a lack of monastics in the West, right? Not here in Perth. In Perth, we've got quite a few monastics of various traditions, but in many other places, a lack of monastics. And very often you find lay people teaching other lay people. Of course, there's nothing wrong with that as such, but still, you wonder whether there is a lack there if there is no monastic order. The Buddha always talked about the fourfold assembly, right? Which is the male and female monastic order and the male and female lay followers. So it should really be fourfold according to Buddhism. If it's not fourfold, then something is missing. So what has happened in the West, they have taken the word Sangha, and the word Sangha always meant in the suttas, when the Buddha spoke about this, Sangha always meant the monastic order. In the West, the Sangha has been slightly turned into just meaning any group of like-minded Buddhists practicing together. So it doesn't really mean the monastic order so much anymore. They've taken that word and changed the meaning of it compared to how it was used in ancient times. So the question is that movement in that direction, is it such a good idea? Or perhaps the monastic Sangha does have an important role and function as part of the Buddhist philosophy, the Buddhist religion, if you like, and all these kind of things. And I think just to get a handle on this, I think it is important to maybe have some idea why this shift is happening in the Buddhist in Buddhism. Where does it come from? Why is Western society prone to this kind of ideas? And of course, the first thing about this is that whenever, and I've said this here many times before, but whenever Buddhism moves from a certain setting and it moves into a new culture, moves into a new sphere, there will always be changes, right? This has happened historically so many times as Buddhism has moved to different cultures and different places. And it's also happening now as Buddhism is becoming more widespread around the world, including the Western world. There's a mutual conditioning going on, Western society being conditioned by some of the Buddhist ideas, and also Buddhism being conditioned at the same time by the Western background. We can't avoid that, right? Because our own background will influence how we deal with these things. It's unavoidable. It's part and parcel of how the world works. Everything is these complex webs of interactions, one thing influencing something else, influencing things in return. And this ongoing process of conditioning is always has to be there. And of course, one of the great important things in Western culture when it comes to religion is the interaction with Christianity. That is such an important thing in the Western, from the Western point of view. And of course, if you look at the history of Christianity in the West, looking now largely at what happened in Europe you had this long, long periods of time when the church was extremely powerful. The church was in political power. The church was basically running whole societies, and there was a lot of oppression because of Christianity. And in the end, that led towards what they call the Reformation, right? When you had all the Protestant movements arising, Lutheranism and all of these kind of things, because there was a rebellion against the church being so oppressive. They wanted to change the ways of the church. And one of the things they changed, which is important for today's topic, one of the things they wanted to do was to take away much of the intermediary power of the church, so there could be more a direct contact between the ordinary lay people and God, right? God, we want to have direct access to God. We don't want to have all this priest in the middle kind of telling us what to do. We want to have more direct access to these things. And I kind of, it's quite sensible in some ways, right? Of course, we want to do that. But this is one of the important things that happened there. And because of that, and because that was quite successful, of course, then the question is, maybe a similar thing should be done in Buddhism. We take away the intermediaries, right, which are perhaps monastics, like myself, chuck those out, and then we have direct access to the Buddha, right? None of this kind of filtering of the original message. Get the real deal straight away. And there's some truth to that. Just like the original Christians, they wanted to read the Bible and they translated the Bible into all the various languages around the world. In the same way, I think it is very useful for also modern Buddhist lay people as well to read some of the word of the Buddha. Not just listen to talks by monastics, because it is, after all, of course it's going to be filtered to some extent, right? I'm not going to sit here just read you the suttas, because you can do that yourself. So it is very useful to actually read some of those words. And when you do that, it empowers you in a certain way. It empowers you because you know that now you have some way of knowing for yourself what the real teachings are. Before, you may have been tricked, right? Who knows what these monastics or these other lay people are telling? Now you have direct access to the teachings. You can kind of check it for yourself. So it empowers you to some extent. It is a kind of corrective to all the teachings you get all the time. What are really the real teachings? It gets you closer to the Buddha. The Buddha is, after all, the real enlightened teacher in this, right? It gets you closer to the Buddha. It has all these wonderful benefits when you actually start to read the suttas for yourself. Not least of all, you discover, are you a real Buddhist, right? It's very easy to think, you come here every Friday night, you listen to the Ajahn Brahm's jokes, you think, yeah, I'm a real Buddhist, I really like these jokes, right? But is that, the Buddhism is a bit more than that, right? Buddhism is a profound teaching there as well. Of course, I'm not Ajahn Brahm, is a mixture of jokes and also very beautiful and profound teachings at the same time. So I'm just exaggerating for effect. Ajahn Brahm does that all the time. I'm just following in his footsteps, right? A bit of exaggeration for effect. That is kind of part and parcel just to make these things work out in a certain way. But read this. Sometimes it is so wonderful and so powerful to actually read a little bit of the word of the Buddha. So because of that, I'm going to read a little bit for you right now, right? Just to get you interested. And then you can decide for yourself whether this is good or not. And sometimes, you know, you sit down, you go to bed that night, and you need something to cheer you up, to kind of go to sleep in a good mood, right? What is better than to read a couple of inspiring verses from somewhere in the Buddhist discourses? And one of the books that has some of the best of these verses, very inspiring verses, is the Dhammapada. If you've never heard of the Dhammapada, they have this wonderful library right over there. Check it out, ask for Dhammapada, and they will point you to where that is, and you can borrow a copy and you can start reading for yourself. And before long, you probably want to buy one because it's so handy. So here are a few verses, right, from the Dhammapada. Very simple things. Very simple, but because it is simple, I reckon it is also truly powerful. So here we go. Everyone trembles at violence. Everyone fears death. Putting oneself in the place of another, one should not strike. One should not kill. Everyone trembles at violence. Life is dear to all. Putting oneself in the place of another, one should not strike, one should not kill. Having examined the entire world, there is no one dearer than oneself. Every person holds themselves most dear. So if you love yourself, you should not harm another. Though one may conquer in battle 1,000 times 1,000 people, yet they indeed are the noblest victors who conquer themselves. Hatred never ends through hatred. Through love alone it stops. This is an ancient law. Right? Is that true or not? Make sense? Yeah, you agree with that? These are some of the verses you find there. This is a little bit of my translation, a little bit adapted, right? I've used this elsewhere before. But what is nice about this, when I read those verses, straight away I think, yeah, this is just so true, right? And it's so inspiring. It inspires you to try to live up to these standards yourself. It inspires you to feel that there's somebody out there who actually understands this world in the right way. So one of the things it does to me when I read this is not so much that this is kind of wisdom which is completely out there and utterly incomprehensible to ordinary human beings like most of us. It is actually that it reinforces the wisdom and the knowledge that you already have, right? And this is the best kind of wisdom, the wisdom whereby you feel, yes, this is just so true. I just needed to hear that to really, you know, enforce that message in me. So I see it, this message again and again. It reinforces the message. It brings out your own wisdom and reinforces your own wisdom, the wisdom that is already there. And this, I think, is one of the most important things for any spiritual teacher, is not so much to give you things that are absolutely incomprehensible to you, but is to reinforce something. It's a kernel, a seed, which is already there inside of you, to make it kind of sprout and come out because the message is already known to you. Awaken the inner wisdom in other people. Because it is when it awakens the inner wisdom inside of us, that is when that message becomes truly powerful. If it is just an external teaching, of course, it doesn't have the same power in your life. So when these people say, chuck out the monks or whatever and go back to the source of the teachings, they have a little bit of a point, right? They don't actually always need to have the monastics to teach us these things. So there is a certain point to that. The question is, how far should we take it? Maybe there is a little bit of room for the Sangha after all. Maybe. This is what we're going to find out during this talk, right? If there is room for the Sangha, if at the end of the talk there is no room for the Sangha, then what shall we do, Venerable Mudu? Shall we have to disrobe in public or something? I'm not sure what we shall do. There's no secret, right? There's no kind of bonus points or nothing here for being able to guess where this is going to go. So you don't get any prize for guessing where this is heading. But anyway, so what does the Buddha say about this? And one of the places the Buddha talks about this, it says that there is like three kinds of fields. People in the world are like three kinds of fields where you sow your seeds. Right? There is the field which is really, really rich. The earth is very rich. And you sow really good seeds in there and the plants sprout up. You get this amazing harvest and you kind of feel very happy. And then there is the middling field, which is not, the earth isn't so good. There's a few rocks in there, right? So when you put your seeds in there, okay, you get a reasonable harvest, but not anywhere near as good as the first one. And then there is the last field, really barren, full of rocks, full of kind of animals and, you know, things that eat the crop, right? So you chuck a few seeds in there just in case, and you get a few kind of straws coming up, but that's about it. And the Buddha said this is like the people in the world. The first field that is really rich and gives a massive crop, that is like the monastic Sangha. The second field, which gives a reasonable crop, but not as good as the first one, that is the lay Buddhists, right? The lay Buddhist community. And the last field, which gives a kind of the odd straw kind of coming out, that is the people that belong to other sects. In other words, people who have a religious or a spiritual leaning in life, but they're not really yet Buddhists as such. Right? So these are the three fields. So this is the first thing that the Buddha talks about that shows you that there is a certain power in monasticism. Why? Because it is a special way of life, a special structure of life that is made in such a way that it gives rise to very rich results. That is where you can expect to find people who practice the path to the full end. That is where you find the richest harvest, right? That is one of the main reasons why the Sangha is so important from from the Buddhist point of view. So why why is it? I apologize for this, but what can you do sometimes? Why is it that the Sangha works works so well? Why is it that it gives the best possible harvest of all people, of all groups of people? And there is many ways of looking at this. There's many kind of many angles to look at this. But one of the ways I want to look at this tonight is to look at the actual structure of the Sangha. Right? I'm going to start there anyway, and then we'll see head in a slightly different direction perhaps afterwards. But first of all, look at the structure of the Sangha. And this is a very interesting way, the way the Sangha is put together by the Buddha. Because of course, the way the Buddha put the Sangha together, he did it in such a way that it optimizes the ability for those people who are there to practice, to achieve deep meditation, to have deep wisdom and all of these other things, right? It is structured to achieve that in particular. And one of the things that it is structured to achieve is harmony, right? Because harmony is so important in our world. You know, sometimes you read about the world in a newspaper and you think, oh, terrible, no harmony, everybody fighting with everybody else, no kind of real kind of brotherhood or sisterhood or common humanity out there, right? There's just so much conflict all the time. But harmony, the Buddha says, is one of the essential qualities to be able to have progress on the Buddhist path. If you haven't got harmony at the base of it all tends to fall apart. And you all know what it's like, right? Sometimes you come here at Friday night and your head is spinning with all the conflicts of the day and all the problems in your life. I would be very surprised if there's almost anyone here who hasn't had at least a little bit of that sometimes, right? Because these things tend to linger in the mind. And if you live in a community, it's almost like living in a family where there's disharmony. It affects you very badly. Very difficult to be peaceful. Very difficult to even relax properly. You feel tense. You feel, oh, you know, I shouldn't have done that. They shouldn't have done that. You know, it's all these thoughts going through your mind. So harmony, says the Buddha, is one of the absolute preconditions for the path to really work. So how does the Buddha structure the Sangha, structure the Buddhist community, so as to optimize the possibility of harmony? And one of the things he says is that one of the things that we need to do in the monastic Sangha is to meet frequently. You have to have frequent meetings, right? And the reason for that is when you have frequent meetings, it means you tend to have a common goal and common orientation in life. You tend to think a little bit in the same way, right? Not too much in the same way, because if everyone thinks too much the same way, it also can be dangerous. But you tend to have roughly a common kind of direction, a common goal, a common purpose in life. And if there are disagreements or misunderstandings, if you meet regularly, you can kind of iron those things out. You can talk about any problems that may exist within the Sangha or the monastic community. So frequent meetings is one of the basic things to enable any institution, I think, including the Sangha, to actually have that sense of harmony. Because without that, you lose your sense of commonality, you lose your sense of common purpose, of common direction, and that is where disharmony very often happens. Right? So frequent meetings is number one. And then, maybe not so revolutionary, but already quite interesting here. Second one, right, which is this is where it gets really quite revolutionary. The second thing the Buddha says is that all meetings of the Sangha should be done in, everyone should be present. Everyone within the Sangha, everyone within that group of monks or group of nuns has to be there, right? And everyone has a vote. So when you have a meeting, and if you are to decide on anything, it has to be a unanimous decision, and everyone has to be present. You may think, and many people think this, this is a recipe for disaster. If everybody has to agree, right, nobody's going to agree. You're not going to get anywhere. You're going to be stuck because nobody ever agrees. There's no such thing as a group where everybody agrees on everything. But actually, if you try to work that system, and I've been living in that kind of system for over 20 years now, it is actually really marvelous. It is actually magnificent how it actually does work. Of course, it depends a little bit on the monastics you have with you, but if they are mature, good-hearted, well-meaning people, and that's usually the kind of monastics that I meet in my life, then it works out. And what is so wonderful about it, that nobody is ever left behind. If it is unanimous, nobody is left out. There's no kind of tyranny of the majority over the minority, right? In real life, when you have a democracy, sometimes if you have a democratic institutions, then if you have a majority and you have a tiny minority, that minority can often be tyrannized. You see that sometimes in certain societies, right? That can be a problem. But if everybody has a vote, if everybody has to be present, it means there's no chance of the minority ever being tyrannized. There's always, everyone has a say. Everybody has to come together. Everybody has to agree. And if there is a difficult person in the Sangha, somebody who kind of puts the spanners in the wheels and doesn't really want to cooperate, then what do you do? Well, then you have to go to them. What is your objection? Why, you know, how can we maybe change the resolution? How can we change this so that this works out, right? And you find a way of dealing with objections that brings everybody together in a harmonious way. And if at the end of the day they still object because simply they just feel it is wrong or whatever, then you ask them, right, are you willing to let go of your view just for the sake of the majority? And usually if people are, grown-ups and they are reasonable and they understand that this is the view of the majority, they usually say yes. And then you can carry on and do your business after all. And nobody actually blocks this resolution that the Sangha is trying to make. You can see how this creates harmony, right? It must create harmony because everybody is on board. Nobody is left out. Everybody has a say. Everybody has an opportunity to make their voice get heard. And it becomes a very powerful way of creating harmony in the Sangha. And it does not block decision making. I think it facilitates it in the long run. It does make the Sangha fairly conservative, which perhaps is not such a bad thing, right? We don't want to be too revolutionary. If we're too revolutionary, you see us running around in jeans one day and that kind of stuff. It wouldn't be the same, right? If I sat here in jeans and had long hair or something, it wouldn't be quite the same thing. Something might be lost at that point. But then again, who knows? So that is one thing. And then you have the another thing which is very interesting. The only way that this kind of system of absolute democracy works is if it works on the local level. Every monastery is independent, right? Every monastery makes decisions that concerns that community. Because this kind of unanimity cannot work if you look at the Sangha, the vast number of monks and nuns around the world. There's no way it can work in that kind of situation. It only works when you have a local democracy. So the Buddha instituted the Sangha in such a way that every monastery, every group of monks and nuns have complete independence in how they run that monastery and how they make decisions and how they actually run their affairs. Right? Which is actually really good. No hierarchy. Nobody coming from the top and tell you have to do things this way. You have complete independence from that hierarchy. It means that, again, you have harmony on the local level because it is at the local level that harmony really matters, because that's where you meditate. That's where you're practicing. The broader kind of Sangha doesn't really matter so much. They will do their own things. You don't need to kind of police the broader Sangha. If the local Sangha is working well, that is where the practice happens. That is where you get results. And so you can see how this is so important for the Sangha to function, that actually you have a local democracy. It's not a big hierarchical thing where you have control from above. That is not, it's a completely decentralized structure, the Sangha. And that is also quite revolutionary when you look at it from ordinary human institutions. Normally, they're not like that at all. Often, they're very hierarchical, but not the Sangha. And I think, I don't know about what you, but I think sometimes, you know, one of the problems perhaps in our Western democracy or democracies anywhere around the world for that matter, is often that people feel kind of disassociated from the democratic process. They feel that the powers to be are too far away from you, right? Who are we actually electing? Who are we voting for? There's too much distance between the person who votes and the people you are trying to elect. And perhaps one of the things that we need more is more of this Buddhist model, democracy more at the local level, not democracy perhaps at the higher level as well, but local democracy perhaps is a place where it is easier for us to feel that we are involved, easier for us to feel that we have an input, right? And perhaps that is one of the things we need to do, bring it back into smaller groups again. Perhaps, I'm just throwing this out there just as an idea, but I think it's important that people feel involved in things, and then they have more of a vested interest in doing something about things in that society. So this is how the Buddha basically instituted the Sangha. He created a system that optimizes the harmony of the monastic community. And because it optimizes the harmony, when it functions well, it functions really well. And it really creates a good foundation for the practice in the monastic community. Most people don't live in that kind of society, right? Most institutions in the world are not like that. They're often a bit more oppressive, a bit more power structures involved. And this has a much more sense of equality to it, which is very very beautiful and very very powerful, I think. Of course, the reality these days is that the Sangha often doesn't function like this. And this is one of the kind of the strange things, is that if you compare how the Sangha was run at the time of the Buddha compared to how it is run now around the world, you often see a big difference in those two. So for that reason, it is important to always try to kind of think, well, what is actually the ideal way of running things? And perhaps we need to kind of claw back some of that. That is one of the things that we try to do at Bodhinyana Monastery. We try to run the Sangha according to the earliest ideals of Buddhism as they were laid down by the Buddha. I wouldn't say we are perfect, but we are kind of, that's what we try to do. And I think that, for me, is a very beautiful and very wonderful thing. So that is the first thing. Now I want to move on. So this is the first thing about the Sangha, right? Personally, I find this very interesting, the idea of how the Sangha is run, because it is quite special, quite unique in the whole world, how it is run. But another thing about the Sangha, which I think is, and this you find more in the monastic rules, how the monastic rules are laid down, and it's expressed through the monastic rules. And that is the idea of simplicity and contentment in the monastic life. Monastic life is essentially one of, you know, having little ownership, owning few things, and being content with the little that you have. For example, when it comes to food, right, we rely entirely on the generosity of the lay people. And it's amazing how generous the lay people are in Perth. Come to Bodhinyana Monastery, wow, it's not as if we starve. If anything, we're getting too fat, right? What a wonderful thing that is, that people are so supportive. And it's very nice to be somebody who is at the receiving end of so much kindness. And actually, it's a very beautiful thing, you know? So that is also very nice. But what it means, of course, is that you cannot really choose that much. Okay, there is quite a lot of food on the table, but your favorite food may not be there, right? So coming from Norway, you can imagine what we eat in Norway. We don't have much of that here, right? Very different. So it's very rare that I get my favorite food. Occasionally, there are some people who actually go out and buy special Norwegian things. Ah, there's one over there. Yes. buy special Norwegian cheese and say, oh, here, I got this Norwegian. I think, where, how on earth did you get that? And she found it apparently in the IKEA store, because IKEA is Swedish, right? Very close to Norway, so she got it there. And I think that's quite astonishing that people go to that effort. So that's very, very kind and very sweet to do that. But essentially, as a monastic, you cannot really choose your food. So you are content, right? Whatever is there is good enough. And after a while, you don't think so much about your food anymore. Because you can't control it, it's a waste of time to think about it. So you tend to let it go. You accept whatever comes there. Then there is the clothing that you wear, right? don't think too much about that either. It looks like this. It has kind of various shades of brown, sometimes a bit darker, a bit more reddish, a bit more greenish, a bit more yellowish or whatever. But essentially, we look pretty much the same, right? It's not kind of, he is really fashionable and I'm not. It's not quite like that. So again, after a while, you don't worry too much about this. Actually, these clothes, I must admit, after a while you get used to them, they're very comfortable. They're very airy and very nice. I really like these kind of clothes, actually. I think if this was the only reason for being a monastic, I might choose to be a monastic because the clothes are so nice. But you don't think about it. So you let go and you allow things to be. And you take the clothes that come, the robes that come, you don't worry too much about it. There are strict rules about this in the Vinaya, monastic rules. You cannot ask for robes, right? Unless your robes burn or get lost, then you're allowed to ask. Otherwise, you can't ask for it. You cannot ask for food. I just mentioned food before, right? Also, you cannot ask for very fancy places to live. You're supposed to live in a small little kuti. Kuti is the Pali word. It means like a tiny little hut. We have those little huts at Bodhinyana Monastery. Each monk has one of these huts. It's about 7 square meters. That's your living space. And it's great to have a living space of 7 square meters. Not much to look after, right? Very simple, very nice. And that's a wonderful thing. And after a while, you're so contented with that. What is more important for me as a monk is all the space I have around my kuti. I can't see anyone from my kuti. It's like I feel I'm living by myself in the forest. That is what is important to me. That's what I think is really valuable. When I go back to my kuti, I feel a sense of solitude, being by myself. Wow, it's so nice. Such a beautiful feeling. That's what really matters. And there are rules, again, against asking for too much from the lay people. There was a time, this was at the time of the Buddha, and the monks were building these really large buildings, right? And this was a fairly small town. The town was called Alavi in the north of India. And the monks were asking the lay people, oh, give this, give that, you know, give a man, give some manpower, give an axe, give some wood, give clay, give grass or whatever, right? And they were asking and asking and asking. And after a while, the lay people got so fed up, right? Oh, these monks are terrible. They're asking all the time. You know what it's like? If somebody asks too much, it's just, whoa, I got enough of that person. So the story goes that after a while, whenever they see a monk coming in the distance, they would turn aside, go in a different direction, hide behind a bush, right? Because the monk was coming. They were afraid of the monks. That's a bit unfortunate, isn't it? It's supposed to be the other way around. And it got so bad that even when a cow was coming in the distance, the cow is brown, they thought it might be a monk. So they ran away because the cow was coming in the distance. That's actually there. It's actually there in one of the stories in the suttas. So of course, when people get afraid of cows because the monks are not behaving rightly, when you know there is a problem there, right? Got to do something. So then the rule was laid down. Monks are not allowed to overtax lay people in that way. Small dwellings, small kutis, is where monastics should dwell. And then there is the most important one about contentment, and that is the rule that monks are not allowed to receive money. Right? So as a monk, you're not supposed to be the owner of any money, nor receive any money. And you know, it's actually really nice not to have any money, because money is something that really obsesses people's lives so much. To be completely free of money is such a wonderful freedom from a burden, actually. You may find this weird, but actually it is true. It is a freedom from burden. But what it means is that you haven't got much choice in life. You can't decide, I'm going to buy this, I want this. You can't do that. You are completely reliant on the generosity of the people around you. And there are some very generous people in the Buddha society. People come to me and say, oh, Bhante, if there's anything you need, please ask me at any time, anything you need, right? And it's very beautiful when that happens. I try not to take advantage of that kind of generosity, because if you do, then you're destroying that beautiful relationship. But that is the right attitude in Buddhism. You say to a monastic, well, if there's anything you need, let me know. And you don't have any money. Because when you have money, basically what you have is you have access to the pleasures of the world. That is what money is about, right? We want money so we can buy a nice house, we can buy the right food, we can have a nice car, we can have all the comforts in the world. That's what money is about. It's about basically purchasing the sensual pleasures in the world. So by not having money, you are forced basically into being content with whatever you have, being content into what people supply you. And that is such a beautiful movement of the mind when you move in that direction. So the Buddha said very strongly in the suttas that a monastic should not have money, because having money is like basically indulging in the senses. He also said very strongly at the same time that a monk or a nun, a monastic who uses money, is a monastic that doesn't shine, doesn't blaze in the world. And he compared it to a monastic drinking alcohol. Right? Or even a monastic having sexual intercourse. That was the comparison. So very kind of strong comparison for merely having money. But that is what the Buddha said. So very strong words there from the Buddha to basically ask the monks not and the nuns not to use money at all. So when you have all of these rules, you can see what is going on here. What is going on is you are forced to move towards contentment. You're forced to be happy with what you have, and the mind starts to become very peaceful as a consequence. One of the most important things on the Buddhist path for meditation to work is precisely the idea of contentment, because contentment is the exact opposite of desire, right? Desire is not being content, is wanting more stuff or wanting different things. Contentment is the ending of that desire, because you're happy. You're content with what you have. Not only are you content with what you have, but you're content with even very little things, very few things. So this is a very powerful support for meditation. And it is much more difficult to realize in lay life, because lay life is more diverse. There's much more easy to get access to all of these things in the world. You don't have a framework around you that helps you in the right direction, like the monastic rules and the monastic setup. And because you haven't got that, you haven't got the same support as we have as monastics to live in this way. So again, you can see how the monastic institution actually supports you and almost forces you towards a way of life which is in harmony, which has a sense of contentment, and that contentment becomes the basis for your meditation practice. Right? This is how it all moves in the right direction. And then, from contentment, there is another set of rules, monastic rules, that can be grouped together as very important for the monastic life. And these are the monastic rules that have to do with not indulging in sensuality, right? Especially relationships and sexuality and that kind of thing. It is very legislated, a lot of rules about that in the monastic vinaya. And there are some very obvious ones, like there's no sexuality whatsoever in the monastic life, right? You can't even touch, if a monk touches a woman or a nun touches a man, and there is some degree of desire there at the time, that is a very, very serious offense in the monastic discipline. You can't speak to a woman about certain things. If you do, again, it's a serious monastic offense. I cannot even be alone in the same room as a woman without somebody being with me, right? Because that too, especially if you have the wrong intention in your mind, is a serious offense. And the question is, why is it? Why is it such a big deal to be with a woman? What is the big issue here? Why all these rules? And especially if you think about, you know, how order, I often do the monastic discipline. I teach that to the monks in the monastery, and I was just teaching all these rules to the monks recently, and the monks were saying, well, why actually do we have all these rules, right? I don't know what they were thinking when they said that, but why do we have all these rules? What actually is the purpose? I think that I'm absolutely sure they came from a wholesome place, but what is actually the purpose of these things, right? It's a good question. What is the purpose of this? Because from a worldly point of view, the idea of relationships, right, of having a wife or a girlfriend or having a boyfriend or a husband or whatever, that's part of life, for goodness sake. It's part of the, you know, it kind of enriches most people's life. It makes it more pleasurable, makes it more happy. Why is this out? What's wrong with this? It's not really immoral, right? There's nothing wrong with having a relationship, for goodness sake. If it's not immoral, why is it laid down in the monastic rules? It's a very good question. Why is this so important? And the answer is, The reason why this is so important is because the whole area of sensuality and sexuality is completely opposed to the idea of Buddhist liberation. All these desires that we have, what they do, especially the sensual desires, they tie us to existence, they tie us to this eternal moving around, going from one life to the next one. Desire is something that always propels you into the future. Desire is always about where you want to go, right? Where you're going to go next. And because of that, because it is this eternal moving into the future, it is what ties you more than anything to the wheel of life and death, which is samsara, called samsara in the Buddhist terminology. Right? It ties you down. And the whole idea of Buddhism, when it taken to its final conclusion, is to release you from that round, to move you away from this eternal moving from death to new life, to death, to new life, going on and on indefinitely like that. The problem with sensuality, it always renews itself, right? You get some sensual pleasure, and then it doesn't really fulfill you. It doesn't really feel, you don't feel complete after getting your sensual fill. You go after another one, another relationship, another kind of item in your life, right? Another house, another thing. And each time you go after it, you never feel that final satisfaction, the final sense of completion, the final, yes, this is it. Every time the desire promises you a sense of completion, and every time it doesn't actually work. And you realize it's always going to be like this. Every time you desire something, it is not actually going to lead to that completion, fulfillment that the desire tells you it will lead to. It never actually gets you there. It never gets you where you want to go. And for that reason, you keep on doing it again and again and again. It's eternally self-renewing. Because it is eternally self-renewing, it means it keeps you moving on the wheel of samsara, around and around and around, from life to life to life. This is what sensuality does. It keeps on dragging you around in the world in this way. And that is why it is problematic. It goes completely against what monasticism is all about. And that is why it is a massive problem. There is a very nice simile about this in the suttas. Back to the suttas again, back to the word of the Buddha. Very profound and beautiful simile here. This is the simile of the dog, the hungry dog that goes to the butcher's shop. And when he goes to the butcher's shop, the butcher, right, he makes sure that before, of course, the dog goes there looking up, waiting for some bones to be thrown out. But of course, the butcher is not going to give any nice meat to a dog, right? This is a dog. The dog is going to get the absolute last, the worst part there is. So he cleans that skeleton, he cleans those bones as clean as he possibly can before he throws them off to the dog. And then the dog, when it tried to eat this bone, all it gets is a little bit of taste of blood, right? Tasting the blood a little bit. And that's about it. Maybe a tiny few scraps of meat. But there's no real satisfaction there. There's no real sense of completion. No sense that now I'm fulfilled. Now everything is okay. So the dog, being desperate, moves on to the next butcher shop. In the next butcher shop, exactly the same problem, right? Still just gets the taste of something. No sense of final satisfaction, no sense of completion, no sense of getting rid of that itch of the desire which is always there. And so the dog runs on and on and on and on, never understanding that the desire is a problem in the first place. Driven by desire, never finding satisfaction, but never understanding where the problem truly is. And this is a simile for the sensual pleasures of the world, right? And this is why it is a problem from the monastic point of view. One of the things I should have said at the beginning, and one of the reasons why I bring this up, this is a little bit hardcore Buddhism, right? So I apologize for you, for those of you who are perhaps a little bit new to this, because sometimes it's like, whoa, is that what Buddhism teaches? Maybe I'm not a Buddhist after all. That's what people sometimes think. But hear this out, because it's only when you hear it out that you can see it in perspective and you can understand what is going on. And one of the reasons why I bring this up is that sometimes people say that, well, you know, one of the reasons why monasticism is irrelevant in the modern life is because in our modern life world, we want to have our sensual pleasures and we also want to have the benefits of meditation, right? We want to have both. We want to have our cake and we want to eat it, right? We're all like that. We want to have as much as we possibly can. But the point I'm making now is that just like everything else in life, you can't both have your cake and also eat it. You have to make a choice sometimes in life. And this is the problem. Meditation, when it also includes sensuality, yes, it can be helpful. It can get you to get you so far, but there is a limit to where it can go. And that is the problem there. And that is what I'm talking about now. So that is what that simile of the dog is all about, right? The dog running around, never finding true satisfaction. And this leads me on to the, now we're coming to the real reasons why monastic life is so incredibly powerful according to the Buddha's teachings. Because some of the most powerful happinesses, some of the most powerful pleasures that we can have, according to Buddhism, are the pleasures of deep meditation, right? Incredibly powerful states of bliss, incredible powerful states of peace, something so beautiful that you realize everything else pales in comparison. So the question is, how can we achieve these states of such powerful bliss? If they are there, then surely it is something everybody would want, right? Nobody says no to bliss. Nobody says no to happiness if it is there for the taking. So the question is, how do we get there? And one of the crucial things to understand is that these blisses of deep meditation, they are diametrically opposed to the happinesses of the senses, the sensual happinesses. These are completely crashing with each other, right? And that is why, if you want to go that deeper to that deeper level, if you want to experience those profound happiness that come through deep meditation practices, you have to abandon those sensual pleasures, at least temporarily, ideally more permanently, and then they become accessible to you. Why is that? Right? Good question. Why is that the case? And it is actually quite simple. Because all the sensual pleasures of the world are a movement outside of ourselves. If you want to see something beautiful, it is external. It comes through the sense of the eye. If you want to listen to nice music, it comes through the external sense of the ear. If you want to taste a beautiful ice cream, it comes. We just had some ice cream today for lunch. That's why it comes to mind. It comes through the taste outside, right? I enjoyed that ice cream. I enjoyed it. I it was very nice. It's not that you don't enjoy these things anymore, but the idea is to have a different relationship to them. If you want to have a beautiful touch, right? It comes through the external senses. So everything that has to do with sensuality has to do with the world outside of us. Meditation is the exact opposite. Meditation is a movement inwards. It's a movement of relinquishing the senses, a movement of relinquishing the world outside. You have to choose either the world outside or the world outside. If you get a lot of pleasures in the world outside, then when you come to meditation, there comes a point when you won't be able to let go anymore because you are attached to the happinesses outside. If wherever you find a lot of pleasure, that is where you have your attachments. And that's why your meditation would only go so far and no further. So to be able to take the meditation to the conclusion, whereby you relinquish all the external senses completely, and you find the final kind of bliss within, the only way you can do that is by temporarily, at the very least, letting go of those senses and the pleasures that come through the senses. It's the only way. So when you understand that, you understand a lot about how meditation works and about how you find pleasures in different ways and how these pleasures actually are diametrically opposed to each other. Right? So the reality is that as you practice this path, you naturally tend to move in that direction. You don't have to actually abandon anything. You don't have to really give up all your relationships like that and say, I'm not going to have any relationships anymore. If you are heading in the right way and you start to feel the happiness of meditation, it is almost a matter of course that your mind starts to move in another direction. And that is what is so beautiful about it. It's a natural movement. It's not something that you have to deny yourself. It happens in the right way if you practice in the right way. But what is even more important in this is that that samadhi, right? That samadhi that you get, that deep meditation that you get, that is the prerequisite for real wisdom. Only through a mind which is completely purified, which is very empowered through the power of meditation practice, only that kind of mind is able to get truly wise, is able to see things in accordance with the reality. You can't do it with a more weak mind, because a weak mind doesn't have the power to see things through. So that samadhi is required, right? Then true wisdom is possible. Then insight into reality as it actually is, into all the things, impermanence, non-self, and all of these very deep aspects of the Buddhist teachings, only then is that possible. So now you can start, now you can really start to get a feeling for why monasticism is so marvelous, why it is really good, right? Because the whole Dhamma, the whole purpose of these teachings is a movement away from sensuality, a movement towards the bliss of the mind in samadhi, which can only be had when you move out of the world of sensuality, and only then is true wisdom really possible. So what that means is that it is those places where you practice like that, that is where you are by far the most likely to find people who have real deep meditation and who have real deep wisdom, because you have to abandon those things. It is not impossible for lay people who live a very pure and beautiful life, but it's far more difficult, and the Sangha is laid down precisely for this purpose. And this is one of the reasons why you find the Buddha emphasizing the forest dwelling so much for the monastics. It goes so far, and I've said this here before a few times, but it's worthwhile repeating, I think. The Buddha says that the future of Buddhism depends on the fact that monastics enjoy the forest dwellings. Why is that? Because if you enjoy the forest dwellings, that is where you are withdrawing from the sensual pleasures of the world, right? In the forest, you're no longer surrounded by sensual pleasures all the time. It's when you come to the city, right? When I come here, that's when you have to be careful, because that's where the sensual pleasures kind of, you're reminded of these things all the time. In the city, in the villages, in the towns, that's where the problem are. In the forest, there isn't really any sensual pleasure. There's just the forest. The forest has a peaceful effect on the mind, not an effect of desire as sensual pleasures have. So the Buddha lays a lot of emphasis to the point where the entire future of Buddhism depends on monastics enjoying forest dwellings. That is one of these little stories. The other one is this very nice story where the Buddha is walking around and he's seeing the monks, you know, doing various things. And he sees one monk sitting close to the village, straight in meditation, right? Obviously, his meditation is going well, right? He has his eyes closed, sit there for a long period of time, probably has some nice states of meditation, right? And the Buddha sees this monk. And then he goes into the forest, and he sees a monk sitting in the forest. And this monk in the forest is nodding away, right? Oh, so tired. Whoa. Sleeping, half asleep. And then, this is kind of the interesting thing here, right? Because the way people usually think about Buddhist practice, like, whatever works is good. Whatever works is fine. If it works for me, that's the way to do it. But I'm not sure if there's all that much wisdom in that idea. Whatever works, but how do you know it really works? What do you mean by works in the first place? Do you mean works right now? Do you mean works in the long run? What exactly is that supposed to mean anyway? Yeah. I think that it's kind of a shallow way of looking at what actually really works in the long run from a Buddhist point of view. So the interesting thing in this particular context is that the Buddha, he says about that monk who was sitting in the village, who was sitting straight, right, close to the village, sitting in samadhi, sitting in deep meditation, the Buddha said, that monk, I'm not happy with that monk, he's doing the wrong thing, he's sitting too close to the village. Right? He will lose his samadhi, and then he will fall into conversation with some of the villagers or whatever. This monk in the forest, he is doing the right thing. He is practicing the right way. Yes, he is nodding. Yes, he is tired. But because he is in the right place, he will overcome that tiredness, and then his meditation will be solid, and he will not be disturbed in that meditation practice. Right?
is kind of almost the opposite of what people often expect to hear. It doesn't matter where you meditate, as long as your meditation goes well. It matters where you meditate. It matters where these things are done, because the long-term consequences are different from the short-term results. So the whole movement of Buddhism is about being in the forest, being away from civilization, being where you are away from the sensual pleasures of the world, and instead you have access to samadhi, the deep meditations of Buddhism, and also, as a consequence, the very deep insights that follow from that. So this is why this is so important. This is why monasticism actually works so well, because it lays down conditions that make deep meditation insight possible in this world. And it is just so much more difficult as a layperson. Basically, it is almost impossible unless you virtually live like a monastic anyway. So that is the main purpose of this talk tonight. But there is another thing I want to say, as if I haven't been going on long enough already. So I apologize for torturing you a little bit by going on too long here. But there's one more thing which is very important to understand. One of the reasons why monasticism has not been emphasized in certain circles in the Western world, and that is because in certain circles in the West especially, they have de-emphasized the idea of rebirth. They say rebirth is a superstitious, religious belief. We don't believe in that. Therefore, the consequence of not believing in that is basically that monasticism is superfluous. Right? If there is no rebirth, if at the end of this life, that's it, you die, okay, finished, everything is gone, then all you have is you have these few years between now and your death, maybe a few decades, right? And we can usually deal with that. Yes, life isn't always easy, but usually we can deal with these problems. If we feel really down, we come here to Dhammaloka to give us a boost, right? And all of these things, we have our spiritual practices which help us a little bit. We can deal with it. If there's only this life, then the case for monasticism isn't very strong, unless you have incredible deep meditation, in which case monasticism still is really worthwhile. But the case for monasticism isn't very strong. And I have seen many monastics disrobe precisely because they were uncertain about the idea of rebirth. Yeah, I don't really believe in rebirth, so why commit myself so much? Once you believe in rebirth, the stakes are infinitely raised. Because once you believe in rebirth, once you see this wheel of life and death potentially revolving on endlessly in the future, right? I sometimes think about my own life. I've had a pretty good life, right? I've had done all the things that most people want to do. If I look back, good education, nice family. I've never been abused in any way. My parents were extraordinarily nice to me. My teachers were always good. I had a really good life, right? I was never religious before, but that was probably a good thing because religion seems a bit dodgy these days. But, you know, so I had a very good life, basically. My parents were well off, right? Everything, really. And yet, if I think, I've lived 52 years now, if I think back, would I want to go through all of that again? No way! Absolutely no way! There's no chance I would want to go through that again. You know what I mean? There's enough difficulties. Even if you have a good life, there's plenty of enough difficulties already. But when you are setting yourself up for rebirth, you are basically setting yourself up for doing exactly the same thing again. And again, and again, and again. And after 1,000 times of living exactly the life you had now, sometimes much worse, right? Don't forget that. Sometimes much worse. After doing that 1,000 times, you think, jeepers, this is absolutely pointless. I'm going absolutely nowhere. All I'm doing is going around doing the same stupid thing, never really learning anything. I had this wisdom in the past, and I forgot that wisdom. Imagine that. You feel that in this life, wow, my wisdom is growing a bit. I understand a bit about the nature of mind, how to become peaceful and kind. And then you come in your next life, and you get reborn in the wrong family. They teach you all the wrong things, right? You lose all that wisdom. Right? It's like this roller coaster, right? So the idea of rebirth, what it does, it makes this idea of monasticism so much more cogent, so much more important. Why? Because the stakes are raised almost infinitely compared to only having a single life. When people tell me, oh, it doesn't matter if you believe in rebirth or not, you still practice the same path, rubbish. It's not true. There's a complete disconnect there with the Buddhist teaching when people say that. But people say it, and people get away with it. I used to think, well, yeah, maybe you have a point, right? Until it dawned on me, it's complete nonsense. So one of the real foundations for the monastic life actually is the idea of rebirth. The idea of rebirth actually is one of the things that makes this life so powerful and so useful, because you are on the highway of getting out of this massive problem of existence that we all face. So to summarize, there are two main reasons why it is so useful to live the monastic life. One is to overcome the real big picture suffering in the world, right? That's what I've been talking about just now. The idea of going round and round on this wheel of birth and death. This is one reason. That is a pretty good reason. The other really good reason, if you want real happiness in life, if you want the highest kinds of samadhi, if you want real wisdom and real insight into the nature of reality, by far the best place to do that is in the monastic life. Thank you very much, Ed. Okay, so I had no idea it was going to last for so long. I thought this was going to be a short talk, actually, but it keeps on going. Thank you very much, Drew. So does anyone would like to ask any questions? Anybody want to come and ordain now? Anyone, we can shave your head on the spot and ordain you here. Okay, there's quite a few people, so, okay. So, be quick, Eddie, please. Okay, don't go too long. Yeah.
Ajahn Brahmali, the Buddha did predict about the future, you know, regarding his teaching and the importance of the Sangha in preserving his teaching.
Yeah.
He said in the future, people will distort his teaching. And in the future, people will make money out of his teaching.
Yeah, yeah.
You can see what's going on now, isn't it?
Yeah.
The circular Buddhists, I think, they are not contributing to the principle of the teaching this thing, but
so contributing. What do you think about me? Am I distorting?
No.
Am I giving just the real
one
thing?
Moment, And he did also say the importance of the Sangha, the Sangha in preserving his teaching.
Yeah.
And he said that once the last Sangha goes, the whole thing falls.
Yeah, I think
so
that's
it's
true.
It's important for us people here to preserve the Sangha and to be aware of what's going on now, regarding this modern thing going on, which is like tearing the, you can see it, it's contributing to the downfall, tearing back the teaching.
Yeah. Thanks, Eddie. I think that's a very important point. I should have mentioned that, actually. And that is because, the real depth of meditation and the real insight normally happens within the Sangha. And that insight is actually, that is only when you have people in the world who have that insight that the whole Buddhism actually works, that it functions. It doesn't function without that. You need the arahants, you need the enlightened people in the world. Only then does Buddhism sustain itself. Because those people are found in the Sangha is actually, I would say, I agree with you, basically essential for Buddhism to function. Yeah. Okay, there was a couple of, one over here. Yeah.
So if we were all to be free of suffering and be monastics, on the whole sensuality point, what would that mean for population growth?
if everyone wanted monastic and everyone free of sensuality, great, right? It's wonderful. I don't think we actually have to have people around. If people are more happy, being monastics and celibate, and that kind of gets them the highest happiness, let's go for it, right? If the population collapses as a consequence, probably good for the environment, right? Too many people anyway. So maybe we should encourage that because of too many people in this world. But the reality is that it's not never going to happen, right? The idea of being celibate and living a monastic life is always going to be a minority thing. Only a small amount of people are ever going to do that. So it's not an urgent problem that too many people are becoming monastics. The problem rather is way too few, right? That is the real problem. That is really the main problem in the world. Because it is a It is a really marvelous way to live. It is a way to live that gives rise to very, very, a lot of extremely positive things. And I can't really recommend it enough, but it has to come from the heart, right? If it doesn't come from the heart, then of course it doesn't really work. But it's not a problem. And even if everybody became monastics, well, great. I think it's a wonderful thing, actually. Yeah. But it's not going to happen. Are you happy with that? Not quite happy. Okay. So,
if the Dharma takes root, then you would say that, and if, you know, in future generations, then.
Yeah. This is one of the things about Buddha's teaching is that as long as there are beings, those beings will suffer, right? This is the nature of the human mind, basically. The human mind is run by defilements of things like desire and anger and these kind of things. And because the human mind is run by these things, you cannot really exist without suffering. Suffering is inherent to existence. So because of that, it's always nice when people, you know, strive to get out of that. It's always a positive thing. And I don't think a few less people in this world will really matter that much, you know, if we can reduce the world population from 7 billion to even, you know, if we imagine how much space we had if there's only 7 million of us, right? We have all this space to roam around. And that would be okay. I don't think there's any problem with that, personally. Okay, anyone else? John, do we want to use the microphone or how is it? Yeah, John over here.
Recently you went to Africa. Could you tell briefly about Buddhism in Africa and what you found?
Look, I didn't go for Buddhist reasons, you see. I went to Africa to with my family. My family said, oh, please come to us to Africa. And I went with my family. So I went on a safari and that sort of stuff in Africa. It's a bit like a holiday, right? But what is very nice about it is that What is nice about going with my family? First of all, when you are the son, you have a kind of responsibility to your parents especially and your family more. So there's a chance to spend some time with them. This is where they wanted to see me, so you accept it mostly for that reason. You saw a lot of, you know, fancy wildlife at the same time, but that's another side of the story. But what is really nice for me about this thing is that my family is actually interested in Buddhism, right? They weren't before I became a Buddhist. It took a long, long time for them to become interested, but now they're interested. So my father says to me, well, you know, we spent a few days on the beach outside Zanzibar, right, on one of these small islands there, very fancy, very nice. He said, well, every day, every morning, we want to have a short meditation session, a short Dhamma talk together. Right? So I was sitting there giving a Dhamma talk, a meditation to my mother and father, my brother and sister, and the in-laws, right? They were all there listening to me giving a Dhamma talk and meditation. And it's really nice, right? You feel that you are able to give something back to your family that is really valuable. They have supported me incredibly well throughout my, you know, through my upbringing and everything, really, really well. And now it is my opportunity to give something back, something really, really valuable back. And then they tell me, wow, this is just so great, so wonderful. They really get into it, right? And it's, I feel very, I must admit, this is one of the kind of highlights for me, is the fact that my, you know, I can do this to my own family, because it's actually quite rare for parents to take their son all that seriously. Oh yeah, he's kind of doing his own thing, you know, going a bit funny, being a monk or whatever. No, they actually take it seriously. So I'm really, that is one of the things that I find that was the best thing for me about the whole trip, and just to be around them and all that kind of thing. And seeing all the little nieces and nephews grow up, right? They kind of get up to grow up with a uncle who is a monk. That's pretty cool as well. So, so that was the highlight of my trip to Africa. Apart from that, no Buddhism. They looked at me and they looked at me and said, oh, you come from some strange tribe. Your clothes are very strange, right? That's what they said to me. No, no, not the tribe. This is a religion. I said, like Islam and Christianity. Oh, Islam and Christianity. Okay. They had no idea about Buddhism, which was actually quite sweet. So, anyway, any other questions? Okay, so let's take the questions from overseas. So we have, okay, so the first one here is from Martin from the Netherlands. Hello, Martin. How do monks that admonish others or get angry at others in order to teach something or provoke the other person's defilements fit into a harmonious sangha? That's a good question. How do monks that admonish others or get angry at others? Well, admonishing others is sometimes required. Sometimes you have monastics who behave incredibly badly. Sometimes you have monastics who become monastics so they get a meal every day, right? This is actually true. This is found especially in India 2,500 years ago. There were some people who were extremely poor and they thought, I can either work really hard or I can put on a robe and shave my head and eat happily every day, right? Which one is easier? Okay, become a monk. Or the Buddhist monks had really good medical care. Some of the best doctors were looking after the Sangha. So people, I've got this terrible illness, can't afford a doctor, let me ordain. As soon as they were healthy, they disrobed again, right? That kind of stuff. So sometimes you have to admonish, because sometimes there are people that don't fit in to the Sangha whatsoever. And sometimes monks have to be expelled. The most serious rules against the monastic discipline, if you steal, for example, or you kill somebody, you get expelled from the Sangha. You get expelled because you have broken the promises of leading a pure life to such a profound extent that you no longer belong to the monastic Sangha. So it is necessary, right? If you don't do that sort of thing, the Sangha gets rotten from within and the whole thing starts to collapse as a consequence. So you have to have these rules as well. So sometimes you have to admonish somebody, but when you admonish, you do it in a nice way. You say, Venerable Mudu, I have only nice things to say about you. You're the most wonderful thing in the world. But there's this one tiny, minor little thing, which I'm wondering whether you would like to look into. I don't even have a tiny, minor thing with Venerable Mudu, but there might, so maybe there will be in the future. And please also, if I ever do anything wrong, please, admonish me in return. And then you kind of have a nice balanced relationship. So admonishment is sometimes necessary. But getting angry in order to teach something, I think that is always unskillful. I think that is really strange. And I think that I wonder how that is possible. There is no evidence in the suttas of any monks or the Buddha or anyone ever getting angry, right? That Buddha is supposed to have overcome all anger. The Buddha specifically says, if you see anger in me, well, then I'm not enlightened, right? So if you see anger in somebody, that they're not enlightened, essentially. We are supposed to use our own common sense and look at people in such a way as to judge them based on these kind of things. If you see anger, person is not awakened, they're not an arahant, end of story, really. So that is really weird. So provoke the other person's defilement. I don't believe in that sort of stuff. I think that kind of stuff is the stuff of myths and legends. Nobody who really has their act together acts in that way, as far as I know. Okay, so thanks for that question. Then we have Jose from Ecuador. Wow, it's really cool. Netherlands and Ecuador. And the next one from Singapore. It's really, really nice everywhere around the world. It's really, really good. So how to overcome the loneliness of not having a sangha in my country? Problems are everywhere and I want advice and refuge. Do you send monks abroad? I don't have Australian visa. Okay, well, one of the wonderful things about the modern world is that we have the internet, right? The internet can be used in many bad ways, but there are some good ways of using the internet as well. And that is to get access to good Dhamma teaching. So you are welcome. You are part of the group here, right? Can you see us now? Hello, Jose. You are part of this group when you come here and you meditate with us and you listen to Dhamma talks. And we take everybody who listens to us, we take them seriously as well. So don't feel that you don't have a sangha. You have a sangha, yes, cyber sangha, that thinks about you down there in Ecuador. It's really wonderful that we can reach Ecuador, right? I'm really, really happy about that. Sometimes, if you have a group of Buddhists, you can invite monks to your country. That is a possibility. There are some monks who might be interested in that. I don't think you're going to get Ajahn Brahm, unfortunately, because he's already so busy. He turns down 3 out of 4 invitations he gets already, so that's very unlikely. But there are often that you will find somebody, probably, who you can invite, somebody who you have some degree of faith in, right? Maybe, I don't know what your financial situation is like, but maybe you can come on a long visit to Perth, right? Or somewhere else, where there is a nice sangha that you have some confidence in. You can take part in a retreat, perhaps, or you can kind of stay at the monastery for a while, and these kind of things to give you a bit of boost in your life and ask a few personal questions and all that kind of stuff as well. Right? Then there is the really radical option. This is what I really recommend you to do. And that is to, next time you have an opportunity, shave your head, put on the brown robes, and ordain and start your own sangha in Ecuador. And then you become the refuge for all other Ecuadorians who need this kind of thing. Wouldn't that be wonderful? And maybe you can even come here to Perth if you like and train here for a while if you wish. Then go back to Ecuador and start the Sangha there, and you become the refuge for all those people because you understand the importance of having that ability to approach monastics. And then you become an incredible blessing for your own countrymen. Anyway, just a few possibilities there. Okay, the last question is from Legolas. Legolas from Singapore. May I ask for advice on approaching Buddhist society, but I'm socially introverted. How do I reconcile these two aspects? Okay, so you don't have to be very socially extroverted to be in part of a Buddhist society. No, a lot of time we sit down and just close our eyes anyway and meditate. You don't need to be very extroverted for that. You know, a lot of monastics are not very extroverted. I'm not really very extroverted myself. I have to talk when I sit here, so maybe I seem extroverted, but actually, I like to kind of hang out by myself. I don't really look for much social involvement, to be honest. But just, you know, come and sit at the back, listen to the teachings, do the meditation, you know. You don't have to interact so much with people. The most important is just to be there and to enjoy the teachings. So interaction is not necessarily so much a part of the Buddhist path. It's more the practice in the right way. And socializing is not really part of the practice. The socializing you do, we all have to do a little bit of socializing, even if you're introverted, but you do that in the right way. What matters is doing it in the right way, not how much you do it. Yeah. So just enjoy, and then you will be on the right track. Okay, great. That's all for tonight. Anything last? Anybody happy? Okay, so let's pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.
Satipanno bhagavato savakasangho sanghang namah.